Accession number 21095, Reel 30.
Hello, Pick, Reel 30.
So we've been discussing one's news sources. Well, I can only emphasize again and again that you depend on a large variety of sources. Sometimes just some odd remark that in its immediate context wouldn't be particularly meaningful. You pick it up. If you've got good political antenna, it might mean something to you. And it helps you to look for information, to look for changes of policies. For instance, I used to obviously invite sources, people that I was cultivating for lunches, and you would roam around the farmyard and everything else, and then somehow some little snippet would stick with you. You couldn't be quite sure whether that was deliberately planted so that you would do something about it, or whether it was just an offhand remark. But you always built on things like that, and I would come away from lunches like that, where you obviously couldn't take notes while you were talking, and get back to the office and make myself a few notes on what had been discussed. Not always, but when I thought it was important. And so that's the way you do it. And of course, if you have these sort of organized lunches, groups lunching one particular source, well, that's different, because then everybody is taking notes as the meal proceeds. But it's a lot of things are sort of almost accidental, just because you have a nose for something, or you've just asked the right kind of question, and it produces an answer that gives you a lead into what you're already thinking or what you already know, and so on and so forth.
When you were covering the sort of Cold War area, did you ever have information from the Information Research Department of the Foreign Office?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, the Foreign Office to some extent, yes, because they were always putting out their sort of country reports and so on. But a great source was Radio Free Europe, which regularly published a lot of information, also particularly, of course, what they were listening to and hearing from the communist bloc camp. Also BBC monitoring at Caversham, which, nowadays I suspect very few news organizations still subscribe to that, but certainly The Guardian did in my time, and equally the Radio Free Europe, because it was not cheap to subscribe to their services, but it was considered essential for anyone who was trying to cover Eastern Europe, because those two organizations were the listening posts. And they also employed people who did a lot of original research into any manner of things, from sort of agriculture to propaganda to arms, and certainly endless publications on arms issues, arms control issues, arms negotiations, and so on. So that was all invaluable material. No, I mean, look, you could spend 75% of your time just reading on Cold War issues, but the important thing to my mind always was to get out and go and just talk to people, observe, go to Eastern Europe, be in Russia and so on, and observe what was really happening. And of course, as things got sort of beyond the methods of the criminologist, who would study photographs and from the photographs extrapolate the standing of the various members of the Politburo and so on, to actually covering events where these people appeared, where you saw them in flesh and blood, and could put faces onto the names and so on, and living faces as distinct from photographs. To my mind, that was always very important, and I think a good journalist has to be able to report, in other words, to observe life as it's lived, as it's spoken, as it happens, and not just use written material.
Yes, it was interesting when you were talking about Poland and solidarity, you know, how you were anxious to get the official side as well as the sort of solidarity,
well,
the
yes.
opposition movement. That was very
well,
interesting.
Well, I think you know, you had to listen to, always, it's always been important to listen to briefings, but and unfortunately you also have to read a lot of the speeches and digest them and decide for yourself what are the sort of new aspects of what are often very lengthy and boring diatribes.
And did you find, you know, particularly when the Cold War was, you know, at its iciest, that you had to be careful that you weren't being fed, you know, mere propaganda? I was thinking of the Information Research Department and
when you always
briefings.
When you always assume that you're, you know, whether you're East or West, though, I mean, obviously, in the communist world, whatever briefings were available, and there weren't that many available, you just knew that they were biased and that you were not being told the straight story. But you equally had to be on your guard in Washington or London or Paris. And, you know, governments on the whole want reporting to favor their positions. And they will be selective with the information they give you, selective with the truth. And, you know, the only way that you can get at an approximation of truth is to not just listen to one side or the other or to one country spokesman or another, but to see as many points of view as possible. But, of course, when it came to reading official declarations and particularly speeches, and speeches always have been very important in the East-West relationship, you know, you just had to have enough experience to make up your own mind what was important. I mean, judgment does enter into all these things. You can't just regurgitate what somebody tells you or what somebody says.
Did you know about the Information Research Department, though? You know, was this well known that the Foreign Office had this department? You know, which.
I think anyone who had any connection with the Foreign Office knew it, but. You were always speculating who was working for intelligence and who was not working for intelligence, and the Foreign Office Research Department is certainly on the edge, if not part of the of the intelligence activities of the Foreign Office and indeed of the British government. And I mean, you were always you could always have an inkling of who might or might not be working for intelligence, especially in the sort of smaller countries where you had fewer posts and where, you know, you had relatively fewer diplomats, British diplomats or American diplomats and so on. But, you know, you, as a journalist who covers foreign affairs, you're always aware that you can't, you know, a lot of the perfectly bona fide officials will have access to intelligence reports. Therefore, you're being briefed partly on the basis of what they've seen, certainly also what they're allowed to say, of the extent to which they trust you. You know, background briefings, by definition almost, no, I'm sorry, it's not the right basis. Background briefings on a small scale, particularly on a one-to-one basis, only happens when the particular person in question has sufficient trust in the journalists they're with to, if they're going to give you information as distinct from just putting over a line, if they just want to put over a line, well, then it doesn't really matter who they're talking to. They just hope the line, or the other person, is too lazy to do anything about it. But certainly in my case, and I think in the case of all my colleagues who covered, who were diplomatic correspondents or diplomatic editors here in London, we were all well aware that the amount of information that we got was directly related to the trust that the officials had in the person that, you know, we would not give away our sources. And actually, talking about this, it does remind me of one thing. When I first took over as diplomatic correspondent from Patrick Heatley, who had been my predecessor, Foreign Office briefings were still conducted on a very different basis. They were only the journalists who were briefed had to agree to their colleagues who also participated in those briefings, or indeed even who got one-on-one briefings. It was a sort of little, you know, almost tantamount to little trade union, that the sort of most senior of the diplomatic correspondents had a virtual veto on the other correspondents who were allowed to share in this. It was all done on a much more restricted basis. And in my case, the then sort of senior diplomatic correspondent was the BBC's diplomatic correspondent. And he refused he said no, he would not accept me. Now, whether at the time that was because I was a woman, it's perfectly possible. But this vendetta went on for quite some time, and I had to be given separate briefings because this one man would not allow me to participate in the group, which at that time consisted of no more than three or four people, and just the Times, the Financial Times, and the Guardian, and BBC, and so on. And this led to an official complaint by the editor of the Guardian, and it was finally. But I don't think it was settled until that particular correspondent retired. It was very unpleasant, and that entirely changed because after a while, the Foreign Office News Department just decided that anyone who was a diplomatic correspondent or who was perceived as diplomatic correspondent could be accredited to the Foreign Office and have a Foreign Office pass. And we had to have passes. I mean, we had to be vetted, that you could then come and go freely, to the briefings. But when I first started, those briefings were much, much, much more restricted institution, and as I say, very unpleasant.
Did you cover any of the spies? McLean and Burgess and Philby. Were you involved with that?
No, not at all. I mean, Claire Hollingworth was with Philby. This is a well-known story, but she filed a report saying that Philby had defected, she filed it from Beirut. And the Guardian was afraid, didn't believe, wasn't certain about it, and was afraid that Philby would sue. And so the news story was not published, and the Guardian missed a huge scoop. but the only extent to which I was ever involved with all the sort of with the spies was whenever spy exchanges were agreed between Britain and the Soviet Union. I would write the news story of that, or equally when people were expelled and arrested. And in East Germany, interview the East German who was the intermediary between the GDR government and the Russian government and the West in the sale of political prisoners, but in the sort of major spy stories, no. I was just a reader of John le Carré, whom I got to know later quite well.
Did you work directly with Claire Hollingsworth?
No, never. The only I remember Claire. Claire gave me quite a lot of advice when I first went to Washington on how best to handle myself. And later, of course, she didn't go on working for the Guardian, and I think we were both together in Romania once, but yes, and that was actually quite funny because we were in the presidential palace and observing some banquet between a Chinese prime minister, I think, and Ceausescu, and she said in that very loud, penetrating voice that she has, "Things were not like that when I was last here with the king." But anyway, no, but Claire's always remained a friend. And she's a very, very special person.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, when you went into this, whether you had any sort of mentor or a woman mentor or role model. Was there, you must have been one of the pioneers, really, in diplomatic...
No, I don't think I had a role model, but Claire, you know, to the extent that there was a role... Well, up to a point, you know, Claire, I admired Claire simply because she got out of the women's ghetto long before anybody else, really, in the British press. And because she was a very kind person, and we did come across, you know, we came across each other in Paris at various points. And of course, later on when she was in Hong Kong and I would visit Hong Kong, and again, she would really sort of lay out the red carpet for me always, and give me introductions to people and fix things up. She's a very warm and generous person. But you know, as I said before, I mean, her style of journalism isn't mine. She relishes wars, and I most definitely do not. On the other hand, I hugely respect the fact that she achieved what she achieved, and also that she really became such an expert both on arms control issues and of course on China, and on my visits to Hong Kong, you know, I think she really guided me a great deal on what was going on and what were the things to look out for and so on. And she's just, you know, if you can talk about role models up to a point, yes. But, you know, I'm equally close to, for example, also a friend of mine from the Guardian days, who is no longer there, but who is younger than I am, and who has now become the head of the School of Journalism at City University, and whom I admire hugely, both for her commitment to women in journalism and to the way in which she's able to motivate new generations of journalists and is actively helping to promote women, and how far they've, under her sort of tutelage and influence, that she's been able to place them in really key positions. And I think, you know, if I started all over again, I would certainly see her very much as a model of how you can both work for yourself and also stimulate other people into working, and just the sheer commitment that she brings to the promotion of women in journalism, which is something that I don't think I've done. You know, I think you know, if I reflect on whatever achievements I have, I think one of my great failings is that I never went out of my way to help the advance of other journalists, male or female, but certainly that I never really became involved in organizations that would try to promote and help women in journalism.
What is the name of that woman?
Linda Christmas. Linda Christmas. And she, interesting enough, when she first came to The Guardian, she was the woman's page editor, and then there was endless agonizing on The Guardian. We couldn't go on calling it woman's page. I mean, she was Mary Stott's successor, Mary Stott, who, of course, pioneered women's pages and hugely extended the coverage and the range of women's pages. But Linda, who is equally committed to a very, very broad spectrum, had this problem, you know, what do we call this page? At first, it was renamed, I think, at one point, Miscellany, and it went through various metamorphoses, and now we're back to women. But it took a long time before we got back to women. But she, interestingly enough, now again, you might say that that's discrimination, but I'm not sure. She got very interested in Australia and decided that she wanted to write a book about Australia and travel through Australia. And she asked Peter Preston, who was then her editor, for a sabbatical. And he refused to give it to her. And the upshot of it was that she left the Guardian. She wrote her book, but left the Guardian. Now, whether if she'd been a man, Peter might have liked her better, might have been prepared to let her go. You know, who knows what kind of prejudices enter into those decisions. It's perfectly possible that he'd made up his mind that she was a difficult person to work with and he would prefer her not to be there anymore, and this was the sort of great and the sort of elegant way out. But whatever it was, in my time, a lot of people, including myself, were allowed to take sabbaticals, and she was refused.
What was Richard Gott there?
Yes, he was.
Yes. Mm. I remember that he was accused of taking Russian gold, of having rather close links with the Russians.
Yes, well, whether he allowed himself to have to take Russian money to pay for one or two trips, whether he did that out of sheer cussedness I think he did it out of cussedness and out of stupidity. I mean, there's no doubt that Richard was left of centre, but on the other hand, I don't think Richard was a traitor, and I don't think he was actively working for Soviet intelligence, but it was a silly thing to do, and he knows that, and he's suffered for it ever since, because he was forced to leave the paper. But I don't consider that to be. I think he is not material that any intelligence service would want to recruit. He is the most indiscreet and the most unreliable of people that I've come across. And I mean, he's a one-man band, and I suspect, but not in the sense in which spies who have information to disclose would operate. I mean, he's a one-man band in the sense that he always just looked after himself. But in any event, you know, he had no access to any kind of information that could be of any interest to a foreign intelligence operation. I would have been of far greater interest to them. And I must say, nobody ever approached me. I can say that. But I mean, from neither side, neither from the Western side nor from the Communist side. I was probably considered too unreliable by all of them, too independent. I mean, we've talked about Richard Gott, and I just think he was a left-wing maverick, and not much more than that. And as I said, I don't think he had any access. No one would have ever trusted him with really confidential information. I could be wrong, but I think so. I'm not aware of having had any close contact with fellow travelers or anyone who might be considered to be spying or at least informing on me or what I was saying to any other government. But of course, there's one big exclusion to this, which is that, of course, in the course of my work, I got to know or was befriended by the press attaches of the various East European Communist Bloc countries, and in particular, of course, the Soviet embassy. And, one would be lunched from time to time, invited to the Soviet embassy, Czech embassy, Romanian embassy, you name it. And you had to assume that, you know, whatever you said in the course of a lunch or in the course of a briefing or in the course of being there, that would be reported back home. Equally, you had to assume that when you mixed with East European or Soviet journalists, that one of their jobs was to report back on what you were saying, what you were writing. You felt a lot of the time, of course, that you know they would take the pieces that you were writing and passing that back as if it had some deep inner meaning, way beyond anything that you might have written. But you had to be on your guard, and you know you had to know what the limits were of what you could say to these people, simply in terms of, you know, here was I, obviously, being briefed on a fairly regular basis by British sources. Well, you know, you had to, if you felt that if you were at all responsible, I think you had to exercise a degree of self-censorship of what you, the terms on which you spoke then with these press attaches or the other journalists who were clearly aware that you were being briefed by British sources and, you know, who would dearly like to know what you were actually being told. Well, you know, most of what I was being told and what my colleagues were being told, you know, was reflected in what we wrote, so that, I mean, to that extent, an intelligent press attaché could put two and two together. But you didn't actually have to actively help him get even more. And I think that that is something that I think, you know, you had to exercise, I think, a degree of responsibility, which not everybody would have agreed with. I mean, and Richard Gott is a prime example. I mean, Richard Gott would have passed on, would have discussed anything that came into his mind. But again, Richard Gott didn't go to Foreign Office briefings, though, you know, he probably, like everybody else, would have had sources with whom he spoke from time to time, but not on the sort of consistent, regular basis that the diplomatic correspondents did. And there were certainly other, you know, one doesn't want to name names, but there were certainly others whose sympathies may have been weighted more towards the communist bloc who would, you know, talk without thinking too much of what they were doing. But I don't call that fellow traveling. I mean, it's just, I think, you know, a journalist does have to exercise a degree of self-censorship always. And, you know, you have to make choices. And there are times when you decide you are going to be as outspoken as you possibly can be because you've got a terrific news story, or that you feel that you understand or care about something more than somebody else does. But then, you know, you risk losing your sources, and you have to weigh up one against the other. I mean, it's as crude as that. I must say, I, for a long time, when I stopped being diplomatic editor, was writing editorials on foreign policy issues for The Guardian, and I found that in some ways a real liberation, because there you could say all kinds of things that you wouldn't have written when you put your name to a piece. But when you are just expressing a view, you can suddenly be much more outspoken, because you're not protecting yourself against tomorrow's briefings in the Foreign Office or at the American Embassy or wherever, and you can just speak out your own mind. And that was fun.
Did you ever have any contact with the Soviet Relations Committee that was set up, I think it was in the 1960s, for East-West relations on an official level?
Well, I haven't even heard of it, so I don't know if I've had any contact with it. I don't know. I mean, you know, the only... I regularly visited the various institutes in Moscow when I was like the Arbatov Institute and the various other specialized institutes on foreign relations and arms control issues and so on, but I've never even heard of this committee. But I don't know who was, I mean, maybe I've had contact with it without knowing it, but I'm knowingly not.